The provisional agenda for the present meeting is contained in document S agenda 1025, which has been circulated to members of the council. If there is no objection, I shall consider this agenda as approved.
The provisional agenda for this afternoon's meeting has been distributed in document S/agenda/1025. If I hear no objections, I shall consider the agenda as adopted.
L'ordre du jour provisoire de la séance de cet après-midi a été diffusé dans un document sous la côte S agenda 1025. S'il n'y a pas d'objection, je le considère comme adopté.
The agenda is adopted.
It's adopted.
In accordance with the decision taken at the 1022nd meeting of the Security Council, I suggest that we invite the member of the representative of Cuba to take a seat at the council table without the right of vote.
At our 1022nd meeting, I invite the representative of Cuba to occupy his seat at the table and to participate in the discussion of the council in a consultative capacity.
Conformément à la décision prise à la 1022e séance du Conseil de sécurité, je me propose d'inviter le représentant de Cuba à prendre place.
With those words, Dr. Garcia Inchaustegui was about to take his seat, but the interpretation hadn't been concluded. You understand that all words must be said in both English and French. In this case, Mr. Zorin speaks Russian, so everything has to be translated consecutively. Now the delegate of Cuba has taken a seat. Here is Mr. Zorin.
For the consideration of the item before it, and the first speaker on my list is the representative of the United States of America, on whom I now call.
Ladies and gentlemen, now here is the most important speech, perhaps, of the day, Mr. Stevenson, right after the interpretation of Mr. Zorin.
Item to take the floor.
Le Conseil va poursuivre la discussion du point qui figure à son ordre du jour. Le premier orateur inscrit à qui je donne la parole, le représentant des États-Unis.
Mr. President, members of the Council, today we must address our attention to the realities of the situation posed by the buildup of nuclear striking power in Cuba. In this connection, I want to say at the outset that the course adopted by the Soviet Union yesterday to avoid direct confrontations in the zone of quarantine are welcome to my government. We also welcome the assurance by Chairman Khrushchev in his letter to Earl Russell that the Soviet Union will take no reckless decisions with regard to this crisis. And we welcome most of all the report that Mr. Khrushchev has agreed to the proposals advanced by the Secretary General. Perhaps that report will be confirmed here today. My government is most anxious to effect a peaceful resolution of this affair. We continue to hope that the Soviet Union will work with us to diminish not only the new danger which has suddenly shadowed the peace, but all of the conflicts that divide the world. I shall not detain you with any detailed discussion of the Soviet and the Cuban responses to our complaint. The speeches of the communist delegates were entirely predictable. I shall make brief comment on some points suggested by these speeches and some other points which may have arisen in the minds of members of the United Nations. Both Chairman Khrushchev, in his letter to Earl Russell, and Ambassador Zorin, in his remarks to this council, argued that this threat to the peace had been caused not by the Soviet Union and Cuba, but by the United States. We are here today, and have been this week, for one single reason. Because the Soviet Union secretly introduced this menacing offensive military buildup into the island of Cuba while assuring the world that nothing was further from their thoughts. The argument in its essence of the Soviet Union is that it was not the Soviet Union which created this threat to peace by secretly installing these weapons in Cuba, but that it was the United States which created this crisis by discovering and reporting these installations. This is the first time, I confess, that I've ever heard it said that the crime is not the burglar, but the discovery of the burglar, and that the threat is not the clandestine missiles in Cuba, but their discovery and the limited measures taken to quarantine further infection. The peril arises not because the nations of the Western Hemisphere have joined together to take necessary action in their self-defense, but because the Soviet Union has extended its nuclear threat into the Western Hemisphere. I noted that there is still at least some delegates in the Council, possibly, I suspect, very few, who say that they don't know whether the Soviet Union has, in fact, built in Cuba installations capable of firing nuclear missiles over ranges from 1,000 to 2,000 miles. As I say, Chairman Khrushchev did not deny these facts in his letter to Earl Russell, nor did Ambassador Zorin on Tuesday evening. And if further doubt remains on this score, we shall gladly exhibit photographic evidence to the doubtful. One other point I'd like to make, Mr. President and gentlemen, is invite attention to the casual remark of the Soviet representative claiming that we have 35 bases in foreign countries. The facts are that there are missiles comparable to these being placed in Cuba with the forces of only three of our allies. And they were only established there by a decision of the heads of government meeting in December 1957, which was compelled to authorize such arrangements by virtue of a prior Soviet decision to introduce its own missiles capable of destroying the countries of Western Europe. In the next place, there are some troublesome questions in the minds of members that are entitled to serious answers. There are those who say that conceding the fact that the Soviet Union has installed these offensive missiles in Cuba, conceding the fact that this constitutes a grave threat to the peace of the world, why was it necessary for the nations of the Western Hemisphere to act with such speed? Why could not the quarantine against the shipment of offensive weapons have been delayed until the Security Council and the General Assembly had a full opportunity to consider the situation and make recommendations? Let me remind the members that the United States was not looking for some pretext to raise the issue of the transformation of Cuba into a military base. On the contrary, the United States made no objection whatever to the shipment of defensive arms by the Soviet Union to Cuba, even though such shipments offended the traditions of this hemisphere. Even after the first hard intelligence reached Washington concerning the change in the character of Soviet military assistance to Cuba, the President of the United States responded by directing an intensification of surveillance, and only after the facts and the magnitude of the buildup had been established beyond all doubt did we begin to take this limited action of barring only those nuclear weapons equipment and aircraft. To understand the reasons for this prompt action, it is necessary to understand the nature and the purposes of this operation. It has been marked above all by two characteristics, speed and stealth. As the photographic evidence makes clear, the installation of these missiles, the erection of these missile sites, has taken place with extraordinary speed. One entire complex was put up in 24 hours. This speed not only demonstrates the methodical organization and the careful planning involved, but it also demonstrates a premeditated attempt to confront this hemisphere with a fait accompli. By quickly completing the whole process of nuclearization of Cuba, the Soviet Union would be in a position to demand that the status quo be maintained and left undisturbed. And if we were to have delayed our counteraction, the nuclearization of Cuba would have been quickly completed. This is not a risk which this hemisphere is prepared to take. When we first detected the secret offensive installations, could we reasonably be expected to have notified the Soviet Union in advance through the process of calling the Security Council that we had discovered its perfidy, and then to have done nothing but wait while we debated, and then have waited further while the Soviet representative in the Security Council vetoed a resolution, as he has already announced that he will do? In different circumstances, we would have. But today we are dealing with dread realities and not with wishes. One of the sites, as I have said, was constructed in 24 hours. One of these missiles can be armed with its nuclear warhead in the middle of the night, pointed at New York, and landed above this room 5 minutes after it was fired. No debate in this room could affect in the slightest the urgency of these terrible facts or the immediacy of the threat to the peace. There was only one way to deal with that urgency and with that immediacy, and that was to act, and to act at once, but with the utmost restraint consistent with the urgency of the threat to the peace. And we came to the Security Council, I remind you, immediately, and concurrently with the OAS. We didn't even wait for the OAS to meet and to act. We came here at the same time. We immediately put into process the political machinery that we pray will achieve a solution of this grave crisis. And we did not act until the American republics had acted to make the quarantine effective. We did not shirk our duties to ourselves, to the hemisphere, to the United Nations, or to the world. We are now in the Security Council on the initiative of the United States, precisely because, having taken the hemispheric action which has been taken, we wish political machinery, the machinery of the United Nations, to take over, to reduce these tensions, and to interpose itself to eliminate this aggressive threat to the peace, and to assure the removal from this hemisphere of offensive nuclear weapons and the corresponding lifting of the quarantine. There are those who say that the quarantine is an inappropriate and extreme remedy, that the punishment does not fit the crime. But I ask those who take this position to put themselves in the position of the Organization of American States, to consider what you would have done in the face of the nuclearization of Cuba. Were we to do nothing until the knife was sharpened? Were we to stand idly by until it was at our throats? What were the alternatives available? On the one hand, the OAS might have sponsored an invasion or destroyed the bases by an airstrike or imposed a total blockade on all imports into Cuba, including medicine and food. On the other hand, the OAS and the United States might have done nothing. Such a course would have confirmed the greatest threat to the peace of the Americas known to history, and would have encouraged the Soviet Union in similar adventures in other parts of the world. And it would have discredited our will, our determination to live in freedom and to reduce, not increase, the perils of this nuclear age. The course we have chosen seems to me perfectly graduated to meet the character of the threat. To have done less would have been to fail in our obligation to peace. To those who say that a limited quarantine was too much, in spite of the provocation and the danger. Let me tell you a story attributed, like so many of our American stories, to Abraham Lincoln, about the passerby out in my part of the country who was charged by a farmer's ferocious boar. He picked up a pitchfork and met the boar head on. It died, and the irate farmer denounced him and asked him why he didn't use the blunt end of the pitchfork. And the man replied, "Why didn't the boar attack me with his blunt end?" Some here have attempted to question the legal basis of the defensive measures taken by the American republics to protect the Western Hemisphere against Soviet long-range nuclear missiles. And I would gladly expand on our position on this, but in view of the proposal now before us, presented last night by the Secretary General, perhaps that is a matter and a discussion in view of its complexity and length, which could be more fruitfully delayed to a later time. Finally, let me say that no twisting of logic, no distortion of words can disguise the plain, the obvious, the compelling common sense conclusion that the installation of nuclear weapons by stealth, weapons of mass destruction in Cuba, poses a dangerous threat to the peace, a threat which contravenes Article 2, Paragraph 4, and a threat which the American republics are entitled to meet, as they have done with appropriate regional defensive measures. Nothing has been said by the representatives of the communist states here which alters the basic situation. There is one fundamental question to which I solicit your attention. The question is this: what actions serve to strengthen the world's hope of peace? Can anyone claim that the introduction of long-range nuclear missiles into Cuba strengthens the peace? Can anyone claim that the speed and stealth of this operation strengthens the peace? Can anyone suppose that this whole undertaking is anything more than an audacious effort to increase the nuclear striking power of the Soviet Union against the United States, and thereby magnify its frequently reiterated threats against Berlin? When we are about to debate how to stop the dissemination of nuclear weapons, does their introduction in a new hemisphere by an outside state advance sanity and peace? Does anyone suppose that if this Soviet adventure should go unchecked, the Soviet Union would refrain from similar adventures in other parts of the world? The one action in the last few days which has strengthened the peace is the determination to stop this further spread of weapons in this hemisphere. In view of the situation that now confronts us and the proposals made here yesterday by the acting Secretary General, I am not going to further extend my remarks this afternoon. I wish only to conclude by reading to the members of the Council a letter from the President of the United States, which was delivered to the acting Secretary General just a few minutes ago in reply to his appeal of last night. He said to Mr. Uthant, "I deeply appreciate the spirit which prompted your message of yesterday. As we made clear in the Security Council, the existing threat was created by the secret introduction of offensive weapons into Cuba, and the answer lies in the removal of such weapons. In your message, in your statement to the Security Council last night, you have made certain suggestions and have invited preliminary talks to determine whether satisfactory arrangements can be assured. Ambassador Stevenson is ready to discuss promptly these arrangements with you. I can assure you of our desire to reach a satisfactory and a peaceful solution of this matter." Signed, John F. Kennedy. I have nothing further to say at this time, Mr. President.
Le représentant des États-Unis.
Monsieur le Président, messieurs les membres du Conseil, aujourd'hui, nous devons porter notre attention.
Ladies and gentlemen, there it is. You had the pièce de résistance in the last 1 minute. Mr. Stevenson quoted the letter from the President of the United States to the Secretary General U Thant. Now Mr. Zorin is going into conference with his advisors and other members of the Soviet members of the United Nations. And what Mr. Stevenson has just said in quoting is that the President appreciates the spirit of U Thant's request to seek understanding between the two sides and for the removal of those weapons which are increasing tension in the Caribbean area, but that the preliminary arrangements between the two parties is the real basis of further negotiation, and that Adlai Stevenson is available to talk with the Soviet Union about those arrangements. Presumably this means that the United States is suggesting to the Secretary General that U Thant arrange for a Kennedy-Khrushchev summit meeting. Mr. Kennedy, the President of the United States, is ready to carry on those negotiations, and the preliminary arrangements can be made, presumably, by Mr. Zorin of the Soviet Union and certainly by Adlai Stevenson of the United States. Now, that is our interpretation. The actual interpretation of the speech of Mr. Stevenson is going on at this particular time, and since Mr. Stevenson spoke for the last 15 or 18 minutes, his speech will be translated, as you can hear in the background, in French, and then we will go back to the floor. So we repeat that, as far as we can tell, interpreting the speech of Adlai Stevenson, the cue words really were right at the end. The United States is prepared to have U Thant bring the parties together, since that was one of his proposals, and incidentally, that is the one proposal that appears both in the United States draft resolution and in the Soviet draft resolution. So you see, there is room for agreement when you come to the question of the parties having bilateral discussions. Khrushchev has said that he is ready to talk with the President of the United States, and now the President of the United States says that he is prepared to talk with the Soviet Premier.